No offense, but your brain is a terrible place to keep your big idea. It belongs in the world, but you know that already. You have a calling, a voice that says, this is what I'm meant to do. Create the website your big idea deserves with Wix. Make it your own with top-to-bottom customization, AI to help realize your vision, and built-in business tools to turn your daydream into your dream job. Wix supports every stage of the business journey, except one. Your decision to begin. Ready? Go to Wix.com.
Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation that works. With the tech to stay ahead and the know-how to act. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver. This is the show that looks at business and politics on a wider perspective. Coming up on the show today, is working from home here to stay or not? We try to get to the bottom of this workplace riddle. Tariffs, of course, have become the word of the year. We'll be looking at Trump's tariffs effects on Ireland and also the wider economic world. Plus this.
It's halftime. Both teams are in their locker room discussing what they can do to win this game in the second half. It's halftime in America, too. People are out of work and they're hurting. And they're all wondering what they're going to do to make a comeback. And we're all scared because this isn't a game.
Now, that was Clint Eastwood's famous Super Bowl ad for Chrysler. And today we'll be looking at the money involved in ads for Super Bowl commercials. You can, of course, email takingstock@newstalk.com. Now, the great experiment of working from home may be ending. From President Trump to Barclays Bank in the UK, workers are being told your office needs you. It may be an extra day per week, or you could be called in for the full 5 days. Even in Ireland, sections of the civil service are being asked, much to the chagrin of their unions, to return to the office for an extra day or two. We are split into three warring tribes now, it seems. Work from homers, work from the office are the people in the middle, the hybrid tribe. So it is a difficult place to be. But we did see Citibank during the week going in the other direction, allowing their bankers to still retain their working from home privileges, if that's what they're called. So what does all this mean for the workplace? What does it mean for organisations? I'm delighted to be joined by Chris Kane, who's the author of Where's My Office? Hello there, Chris.
Hi, Amit. How are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us. Now, Chris, I've got to maybe made it out to be more acrimonious than it is, but we have been seeing a general drift back to the office. Is that how you read it when you survey the evidence, the UK, Ireland, US, across Europe? Is that your assessment of where we're at?
Not entirely, but there's never a simple answer to a complex question. One thing for sure is, work from home and hybrid is surely getting lots and lots of headlines. But it seems that, for the most part, that the typical tendency for industry and sectors of having a herd mentality, it's not working this time around. Hybrid is very much here to say, and the evidence is clear in that one of the acknowledged experts in all of this is an academic at Stanford University, Nick Bloom, who literally a couple of weeks back said, things are stabilizing out at that, even in the across the US, the UK, and across the world. It's about 25% of the working week is that people spend working from home. So, and that's based upon analysis of swipe card access going in and out of office buildings and cell phone locations. So it's a pretty robust piece of research. And, it's something big happened. And I think it happened a long time ago with the arrival of cloud computing. And the whole world of offices, is basically a successor of industrial age factories. Many offices up until the last 10, 20 years were massive paper processing places.
Now, the argument from the people who are, and this is from bankers and people who are clearly self-interested, there's no doubt about it, but let's dissect the argument nevertheless for the sake of this item. They're saying effectively that productivity and mentorship, collaboration, all of those things. Now, I don't know what data they're citing, but they say all of these things improve at some level when more people are brought into the office or asked, requested, whatever word you want to use, to go back to the office. Do you contest that basic intention, or do you say, look, it's a mixed bag depending on the sector? Or
I could show you 10 studies which says productivity improves and 10 which says it's disimproved. Overall, I think it's flat. It's hugely dependent upon the industry sector and indeed the type of businesses that are surveyed. And, you know, the old adage of lies, damn lies and statistics has been well used here. I think the big challenge is that we're trying to describe a very complex issue in using simple terms, because even the word work from home and hybrid means different things to different people. And, you know, we'd probably have need a lot more sort of time than we have today just to go through all of this. But it's not as simple as either or. I think you're going to see much more distributed working, where the office is redefined. Whereas my office talks about this, and where it's no longer just in one place. You know, for many decades, people had to go to one fixed place to do their work.
Sure.
Now you can do your work anywhere. And that doesn't mean you have to work from home. Like in the US, particularly in very congested cities like Los Angeles, for example, some of the smart occupiers and businesses are getting out of their, say, four or five big towers, such as Allstate has just done, and going into 100 different smaller locations. Now, all of those small locations still have groups of people belonging to the...
I know, they're just not in the centralised office. They're
exactly.
In a kind of a hub or sub-office.
If you go into Canary Wharf or any of the big buildings in Dublin, if you were working on the second floor, for example, and I'm working on the seventh floor, or vice versa, we'd probably hardly ever bump into one another.
It's about the economics of all of this, so bear with me on this, but we're obviously in a full employment position in both Europe, the US, and in Ireland. And it's in Ireland, certainly, it's very tight labour market. Like, you just can't get staff across whole segments of the economy. So does that power dynamic, which is currently, you know, probably shifted slightly to the employee and slightly shifted against the employer, does that sort of almost strengthen the work from home hand?
Oh, yeah.
But
indeed,
if we hit a recession, if that power relationship alters, the conversation we're having will also alter. So that's the economic argument, that it's, or probably a power relationship argument, that because employers at the moment need staff more urgently than they have for a long, long time, they have to be more accommodating to them. But that may change, and that may change the nature of this problem. How does that sit with you?
It's a logical argument for sure, except the game, not only is the game changed, but the entire stadium has changed. In that, you're quite right that employee attitudes have changed because they want to spend more time than their fathers in particular spent raising their children. But the other big thing, which once again broadens the whole debate, is the impact of AI and what's that's going to do to enterprises and how they run the office of the future. So office work, the model has been upended, and we're actually living through a period of experimentation as there's a new shape of work actually taking place right in front of our eyes now.
Now, the other one, of course, is this is to take the workers' perspective. This is my job to throw various hats on my head, but the workers' perspective might be, look, a lot of these companies want to bring people back for reasons of control. They can supervise and vigilate these employees. And also, a lot of it's been pushed not by the CEO, but by the middle managers who want to justify their existence as middle managers. I mean, is there any truth in that, in your view?
Entirely, you know, and that has been a big debate. But what has been really emerged is that the people who've truly prospered during COVID, when people had to work remotely, were the organizations which had good managers. You know, management by having bums on seats as a KPI, that's 20th century management thinking. It's gone out the window. Doesn't cut it anymore.
No, I understand that. It's a different style, isn't it? It's a different style of management. I suppose what I do remember during COVID, one of the things was people said, no, people will be allowed to work from home. That will be accommodated. Some people will go back. And we then line up those two groups and we say, well, which one of these two groups is going to do better in a career sense? And there was this idea that, people will be accommodated to work from home or hybrid, but they won't get the promotions, they won't get the pay rise, they won't get the new job from the manager who would prefer the person to be in there. So that part of kind of that, yes, this will be accommodated, but you might lose in terms of career advancement. Are we seeing anything like that, or is any of the data showing anything like that?
Not yet. The issue is, and it's coming very fast, will the managers you're referring to, will that position exist in the reshaped world of business enterprises that's rapidly approaching us? You know, if you look at it, any of us who started work in the 20th century, we were basically victims of being sort of working in homogenized working environments. It was standardization on steroids. COVID not only marked the end of paper, but the end of a one-size-fits-all model. And that includes management attitudes. And if you read all the thinkers around the future of the work model, Bruce Daisley and Julia Hobsbawm, they're saying now is a very different model is emerging. And that's where worker and boss's attitudes are being shaped by this concept of choice. And it'll be different across the industries. And a key thing will be the quality of the workplace and the availability of a range of work settings that allow people to access work when it suits them and when they can be their most productive. And interestingly, you know, this whole movement, one group of society which does benefit are those who have disabilities, who could not access opportunities beforehand.
Absolutely. It's opening it up for them, isn't it? And the other catch cry we heard, again, going back to COVID, where this was all sort of debated, it was kind of banged out at an anvil at the time during COVID. One of the arguments was, you know, people won't have to commute, they'll save money on their train, they'll save money on childminding. So whether it's right, wrong, productive, etc., collaborative and all the rest of it, it was a saving for the ordinary worker who didn't have to get the DART, train, tube, bus. I mean, that argument is still out there, but we don't hear as much about it, even though we're in inflationary times.
Well, it's happening real time in the US, which is now the big petri dish of experimenting how this is going. And workers there value that particular benefit, and they're willing to take sort of 8-9% less in salary for that benefit. But the key thing that the people at Stanford University, and these guys are doing it real time, right up to November, December 24th, the latest data they've been using. And they're saying overall sort of work from home, hybrid, distributed working is here to stay. It's requiring a big shift in management mindsets. And it has huge implications, both positive and negative, on the shape of cities, on the shape of labour markets. But interestingly, also on crime, would you believe? In suburban American cities, crime's down 10% because there's more men around the place.
There's less office workers to be mugged, is that it?
Well, you know, who knows what it is, you know, but it's really interesting. But
yeah.
The other big thing is that as technology advances, work from home, hybrid working, distributed working, however we end up defining all of this, is only going to increase. And technology will enable people to do the stuff that we had to do manually, like sitting opposite somebody senior to pick up tips and whatever. All of that will be made.
And maybe also we're guilty, and I don't include you in this, it would be unfair, but certainly people like me who tend to see this as binary. You know, you've got work from home people here and you've got work from office people here. This will be in the soggy centre. You know, most people will probably be on a hybrid of some description. They'll do 2-3 days a week. So, you know, the actual people who are in the pure end, the unadulterated end, that are all working from home and all working from the office.
Well,
there's not probably as many of those, but there's a huge centre ground who are doing Tuesday and a Thursday, or they come, they work at home on a Friday, all of that. So maybe we're sort of setting one group against each other when actually most people are in a kind of a moderate middle ground. They do a few days here and a few days at home and their boss is broadly happy. So maybe it's not quite as at each other's throat as I'm sketching out.
Oh, well, you're a born pacifist, no doubt. But the statistics give us really insights into this, in that what's happened over the last 5 to 10 years is that 10 years ago, every industry, every company more or less had the same employment profile. And that's all changed. And the people who operate in this multi-dimensioned work setting, shall we say, spectrum, are mainly finance and tech. And if you look at some of them and break it all down, there's still quite a lot of frontline staff in the workplace of the working 5 days a week. They're probably 50, 60%, and they'd be frontline staff and people starting. Then managers and professional, probably about 25% of the workforce work hybrid, and only 10, 12% work purely from home through the working week. And they'd be more IT service desk people. So it's multi-dimensioned. And of course, as I said to earlier, it's going to get even more complicated as AI and virtual enters the model, and we have to think about different ways of how work is done. You might even see the end of the traditional Monday to Friday working week.
Yeah, of course, there's 4 day weeks. You're increasingly hearing that, and some workplaces are already introducing it. I was a bit worried when you started the entire item, Chris, by saying there's no simple answer to this.
Well, there isn't.
You're letting me down here, you know.
You know, people try to break it down into simple, you know, sound bites, for want of a better word. But you hit the nail on the head. The argument has been about something binary, whereas we've all got to wake up and smell the coffee. We're now in the third decade of the digital world.
Yeah, and so it's got to reflect that. Yeah, we can't. It can't be put back in its box. That trend.
The horse has certainly bolted. Whilst many leaders will crave for a return to the office, what they're trying to do is maintain the old order, and that status quo has now been broken.
Okay.
In the middle of this massive...
Well, listen, we'll talk to you again, because the data is just dripping in. So to fully establish a picture, we need more time. So we'll get to that, and we'll talk to you again. Chris Kane is the author of Where's My Office? Thank you very much for walking us through that. And coming up next here on Taking Stock, we'll be talking about those Trump tariffs on Europe and when they'll start.
So you've got a business, but what about a brand? The difference? More of you. Wix gives you the freedom to create your website, own your brand, and do it on your own. Exactly how you envisioned it. Experience limitless customization. Boost your creativity and efficiency with AI tools for every part of your business journey. Scale up with built-in SEO, e-com, and scheduling features. Put more of you in your business. Go to Wix.com and do it all yourself.
And when they stop. Now, you're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver. Now, with Donald Trump back in the White House and him almost following through on his threats to impose tariffs on Canada and Mexico, both allies and enemies alike are paying a lot of attention. The only thing for certain at the moment is uncertainty. So if Donald Trump will, he says he will at least, turn his attention to the EU, what will the impact be both across the continent but also here more locally and parochially here in Ireland? Let's tease out some of these issues with my next two guests. Cliff Taylor is Managing Editor with the Irish Times, and Henry Foy is Brussels Bureau Chief with the Financial Times. Gentlemen, you're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Listen, Henry, I'll go to you first just to get the European perspective, and then Cliff can come in as well on that and the Irish part as well. Suppose one thing that we're very, I suppose there's a certain sense of unknown here. He's obviously taken some steps to put some tariffs on Canada and Mexico. We're told they're postponed pending further agreements and developments on the border of both those two countries. The EU, we're told, has certain measures lined up to retaliate if he makes these moves. So where are we at the moment? Are we just literally waiting for him to happen, to press the button in the next few weeks? Is that the view at the moment in Brussels?
Well, Emmett, all we have to go on is that Trump has said he will, quote, absolutely do this. But as you said, even when he goes ahead and puts the tariffs in place, they don't always come into force, as was the case with Canada and Mexico. At the moment, the EU are in stage one of handling Trump, and that's negotiation. That's thinking about ways you can essentially buy him off in advance of a big move. They're talking about buying more liquid natural gas from the US. There's obviously discussions on, can we buy more American weapons? Are there other agricultural products, perhaps? where the EU could increase purchases. There's also a lot of conversations here in Brussels, public ones, trying to catch the ears of the Americans, saying, look, fine, there's a deficit. You buy a lot of our goods, more than we buy of your goods, but we buy a lot of your services. There's a massive fiscal deficit in the other direction, trade deficit in the other direction on services. Every time a European uses Uber or a Netflix account, that money is transferred across the States. And so this is where the EU is looking at ways they could hit back if tariffs come in. If we're in a trade war situation where Trump pulls the trigger, not just puts the gun on the table, but pulls the trigger on tariffs, one way is the EU can use this anti-coercion instrument. This is a pretty powerful tool, which essentially allows them to put tariffs on services. So big US tech companies such as of Google or Meta could be hit by this instrument that would essentially restrict their ability to do business in the EU through very, very powerful ways. This has never been used before. And there's a feeling here that this is something that they're putting out there to say to Trump, if you're sure about a trade war, you better be totally sure about it, because we have some tools too.
And Henry, in terms of the Brussels view, if you can put it that way collectively, is it that he's there to do a deal, or actually he may not be? We may be looking at a much more drawn out and sort of extensive trade war between the EU and the United States. Or is it a bit like the early forages between Canada and Mexico, where something happens and it's rolled back? Or is this seen as no? Because he makes a lot of very, very strong statements about the EU in particular, says we've been ripped off for years by the EU and so on. Do people in Brussels see this as likely to be long drawn out, or sort of a more short, snappy kind of affair?
I think people do think we can talk our way out of this one with regards to Trump. The other thing that people are taking a lot of notice of is that Canada and Mexico responded quite strongly to those threat-imposed tariffs and saying, look, we'll hit back in other areas, which then saw Donald Trump back down, or at least temporarily. It's a month delay. That may, of course, be extended indefinitely. So there's a little bit of confidence, perhaps more so than 2 weeks ago here in Brussels, that this could be negotiated out of the way. There is also a large understanding that if we get into a trade war, it's going to be very, very bad for both sides. Nobody is pretending that this is a trade war anyone will win, certainly not the European Union. I think it's important. Ursula von der Leyen, the Commission president, said on Monday night, after meeting all of the EU leaders here in Brussels, she said Brussels needed to be, quote, very pragmatic, engage early, and discuss and debate when necessary with the US. And she said she was ready for a, quote, robust conversation with Trump on trade. So I think people are understanding this is Donald Trump. He likes to do deals. There's probably a deal to be made.
Cliff, if I could bring you in, obviously we're more besotted with what's going to happen here, and is there going to be particular measures taken against Ireland? I suppose we don't know yet whether this is an EU affair or Ireland's going to be in some way levied with tariffs on its own uniquely. I presume your thinking at this point is that this is going to be a set of EU-wide measures rather than something that's going to be placed on Ireland uniquely, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
No, I think you're probably right. I mean, technically, perhaps it is possible to put tariffs on individual countries, but of course trade could be rerouted then to try and avoid them. So I think it's much more likely that Trump will target the EU in general. I mean, what he could do is target particular sectors. In one of the sectors that he's spoken about are cars, and the tariff that the EU imposes on US imports is greater than on cars going the other way. So that is something he could look for maneuver on. And of course, the one area that Ireland would be particularly worried about would be the pharma sector. Now, the downside for Donald Trump, if he were to put levies on there, is that Europe is one of the big sources of drugs for the US market. A lot of those drugs are bought by the US government itself. The price would go up for the US government if tariffs are imposed. So there's a bit of circularity there and a bit of a feeling that may be an area that he could be loath to go into. And nonetheless, the pharma sector here is something that has been pointed at by the US administration. We basically get the jobs, we get the tax revenue, and the Americans get expensive drugs, which doesn't seem like a very good deal from their point of view. So it may be that there are corporate tax measures that he could look at there in terms of how income is taxed, or incentives for people to produce pharma in the States rather than in Ireland. So there's a lot to play for Ireland, I think, here. And also in a general sense, but obviously we're a small open economy. We're very exposed to what happens internationally. And as Henry said, if there is a full-scale trade war between the EU and the US, even if Ireland isn't particularly targeted, we're bound to be caught in the fallout of that.
Yeah, it seems to me that the vulnerability is, they keep saying, whether it's Donald Trump or Lutnick, his commerce secretary, you know, we want manufacturing and production to be brought back, reshored or onshore to the United States. Now, I don't know, you know, how they can achieve that overnight, obviously, but if that's their ultimate position, we're going to be sailing into choppy waters for not just the next few months, but for quite a while, at least until we get a fresh congressional election in 2 years' time or so. So this isn't going to just evaporate soon. Sure, it's not.
No, I mean, I don't think companies are going to up sticks from here and head back to America overnight. I think what they will do initially is sit and watch and wait. That's what I'm hearing back from my sources. They're not going to do anything quickly. Relocating manufacturing is a long, complex process. These big pharma plants are set up with kind of 10, 15-year windows or whatever. So I don't think the sector is going to move quickly. But yes, it could hit Ireland in terms of future investments and future tax revenues. I think more likely it's kind of a leaching away over a period of years rather than something that would happen more suddenly. I think the other area where Ireland will be watching very closely is the one Henry mentioned there, the risk of rows in the services sector, particularly relating to the big tech companies. A lot of them have their European headquarters here, as you know. They're very big taxpayers here. And if they were targeted from Brussels and their activities in Europe were targeted from Brussels, that could have implications for jobs and tax revenue here. And I think Ireland will probably try and be a peacemaker in that arena and try and persuade the EU not to go too heavily in response to, initially anyway, to anything Trump might do for fear that things could get worse.
And Cliff, I suppose the problem for Ireland is you hear a lot of the constant refrain, you know, if you're going to deal with Donald Trump, you've got to bring something to the table, you've got to bring something to trade, no pun intended. And, you know, for a lot of countries, they can buy more American products, they can buy more American cars. But Ireland, because of its size, and we're already running a huge deficit with the United States, so there's not much Ireland uniquely can do in terms of buying extra American goods or even services. So we're a bit constrained in that sense of when we go to meet Donald Trump and Patrick's week or whatever, we don't have a whole lot to kind of bring to the negotiation. Sure, we don't.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there are suggestions we could try and perhaps buy more LNG in the years to come. One of the problems there is we don't really have a proper storage facility at the moment. But that could be a route we would promise to go down in future. But you're right, we don't have a huge amount to bring to the table. I think the other thing to watch out for when Ireland Inc., if you like, does go to Washington on Patrick's Day, I would expect some of the big Irish companies who are major investors in the US, the CRHs, the Smurfits, the Glanbys, the Kerry groups and so on, to be front and centre, and for Irish ministers and Taoiseachs to be pointing out the investment and jobs they create in the US. In other words, so this is a two-way street rather than...
Sure, that'd be a good point if it resonates indeed. Henry, could I just bring you in? And obviously, the ultimate competent authority here is the EU Commission. So who do you see sort of leading on this? It sounds like both of you are saying this will happen. There's going to be a trade conflict of some kind, unknown duration at this point. But you've mentioned Ursula von der Leyen. Is it the Commission who'll be writing the policy? Is it the leaders? Who do you see as kind of framing this EU policy when this whole thing kicks off?
I mean, as a trade is an EU competence, the Commission has a totally free hand here. That's something that the member states have given to the Commission long ago. The Commission have told us repeatedly that they are prepared. They have the countermeasures ready. They have the tariffs. They've looked at where they could hurt the American industry, the American sectors the most. I mean, obviously, America has midterm elections coming up, which means Trump's got to hold the House, which means if you're a European Union that wants to get poke Trump in the eye, you're going to target exports from certain states. You're going to put pressure on certain congressmen who need re-election. So if there's one factory that perhaps, I don't know, produces a certain brand of whiskey, you ban that whiskey or you put the tariffs so high, that's going to hurt that particular state. There are very, very detailed plans that's gone on inside the Commission. Those plans have been kept as secret as possible because what they don't want to do is preemptively start a trade war by some of these things getting out, irating Trump and having him respond in advance. This is something that's going to be led by Brussels, without a doubt. The key thing is, do EU states keep their unity throughout? If you have a situation where Trump says, okay, I'm going to really hit the European car industry, that's only going to hit four or five countries. The others are going to think, well, we got away with that. And so when the Commission says, right, we're going to hit back with XYZ tariffs on America, you may see some of those countries that weren't affected initially from the US measures saying, wait a second, should we really be fighting back? That's when the EU unity is going to...
And Henry, yeah, can I also just put another one to you? which is that obviously for a long time, European counterparts to Ireland have been, some people would say jealous, some people would say resentful, some people would say irate about the amount of foreign investment Ireland has secured, the amount of US companies that are headquartered in Ireland. So is it likely, in your opinion, to hard to see the Europeans coming to save the Irish foreign direct investment cluster that they're not necessarily enamoured with in the first place? So if Ireland finds itself particularly exposed, as Cliff says, because of the pharma investments that it does have, it's hard to see other big European countries who are also competing for some of this investment getting wildly excited about that prospect. What do you think?
Well, I think Cliff said this previously, you know, everyone is in this together. If there's a trade war, we're all going to get hurt, whether you're enormous Germany or smaller Ireland. And I think, look at Denmark, what it's going through right now with Greenland. You know, look at how Germany's going to need support from others on the car industry. I think everyone's got something at stake here. And ultimately, at the end of the day, the 27 states are much stronger when they all work together. I would be very surprised if you see countries throwing Ireland out to dry, frankly, on this. Yes, there is a little bit of resentment sometimes as to the amount of FDI, but that's jealousy more than anger.
You said it, not me. Cliff, is the most benign, benevolent interpretation of all of this at this point that the EU agrees to buy more LNG, it buys more weaponry, which a lot of it will be recycled into the conflict in Ukraine anyway, and maybe they, you know, they're upping their spending defence already, that's not new. So is that the most benign version, that Trump settles for that, maybe a few extra Ford cars on the streets of Paris or Berlin? A package is put together and then he backs off and goes off to talk about other things to do with Panama or Gaza or whatever. Is that the most benign version in your view?
We'll all be driving Chevrolets then. yeah.
Pickup truck.
I think it is all right. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how the Canada-Mexico thing plays out now. But is this kind of just going to fizzle out? I mean, the concessions that were offered and given weren't huge, I don't think. Certainly in the case of Canada, the vast bulk of them had been announced before in December. So there wasn't a lot new there, I don't think. The question now is, how hard Trump is going to press for more. He's talked about doing some economic deal with Canada, for example, and there's talk of a seminar being planned later this month. So, you know, is that going to turn into another row? Is he going to actually go ahead and put sanctions or put tariffs at least on those countries after the 30-day period runs out? Or is this going to fizzle out? I think that'll be an interesting marker in terms of how we may approach this whole issue during his term and how we may approach Europe. You're right. It may fizzle out. There may be tariffs for a few weeks. It may all be sorted and life may go on. But I just have a feeling that it maybe isn't going to be that simple.
Yeah.
There's certainly tension with China. I can't see how they're going to be solved quickly. The Chinese won't back down. Quite the opposite, I think. But I think, you know, it's one to watch and very unpredictable and uncertain.
If I could just jump in, I think one thing that's getting people really quite worried here in Brussels is that Trump is conflating this trade discussion with the defense one and talking about demanding 5% of GDP being spent on weapons. For him, the EU, NATO, it's all kind of the same thing, right? Europe is a freeloading state off a freeloading continent off the American security umbrella. There's a worry here that if his ask to avoid a trade war is 5% of GDP spent on defense, that's just not going to happen. And so, and Cliff is absolutely right. What the Canadians and the Mexicans have promised are not really that big of a deal, but they gave Trump some red meat to throw to his supporters. If the actual ask of Europe is 5% of GDP on defense, that's a big problem, and that's something that Europe will not be able to do.
Okay, listen, gents, thank you very much for talking to us. Still getting over the idea of Cliff in a Chevrolet. But anyway, apart from that, Henry Foy, who is Brussels Bureau Chief of the Financial Times, and Cliff Taylor, who is Managing Editor with the Irish Times, thanks to both of you for talking us through that. This is Emmet Oliver here on Taking Stock, here on News Talk. And after the break, we'll be looking at the huge money and strange tastes involved in soup.
So you've got a business, but what about a brand? The difference? More of you. Wix gives you the freedom to create your website, own your brand, and do it on your own, exactly how you envisioned it. Experience limitless customization. Boost your creativity and efficiency with AI tools for every part of your business journey. Scale up with built-in SEO, e-com, and scheduling features. Put more of you in your business. Go to Wix.com and do it all yourself.
Ball ads. Now it is Super Bowl weekend and all roads are leading to New Orleans this Sunday evening Irish time, where the Philadelphia Eagles will try to stop the Kansas City Chiefs from making it three victories in a row, which has never been done before. It really is more than a game, as many viewers will be taking pleasure in getting to see the adverts that are also played, and In many respects, the action on the field often takes second place. These adverts are not cheap. Some companies are paying over $8 million this weekend for just 30 seconds of attention from the mainly American but also global audience that will be watching. And I'm joined now by Carl Waters from the creative advertising agency Folk VML. Carl, you're very welcome along to Taking Stock.
Thank you very much.
Why do people in this day and age of 2025, at least at 24, when we're all online, we're all on social media, why do they take advertising in what is mainly a television event?
Yeah, I think the Super Bowl is something unique within advertising, really, because, as you know, with advertising these days, lots of people will block them out. Lots of people will leave the room when an advert break comes on and make a cup of tea. But with the Super Bowl, it's something completely different, because the Super Bowl is all about entertainment and you've got what happens on the field. You've got the halftime show and you've got the adverts. So what you have is a captive audience of maybe up to 120 million people, and they're there to see the ads, some of them as much as the football. And that doesn't exist anywhere else in advertising. So even though it's huge money, you don't have that level of a captive audience in advertising beyond that. So marketeers, brands...
There just isn't places like that to go anymore, appointment to view type occasions.
Exactly. And you know, you might get your ad, it might be shared online, and you might get a big audience eventually from sharing it online. But in terms of an audience sitting down to watch your ad, that's as big as it gets.
Now, obviously, sport, it's a particular audience. Traditionally, it tended to skew male, probably less so now. It skews particularly in America, sort of beer drinking, working class, blue collar audience. Maybe I'm wrong on all of these, but this is my perception. Do the advertisers care that much about the audience? Or as you say, is it just about getting the creative work out there because it goes online anyway and so on? It's almost like a shop window. Somebody may never come in to buy the product, but they wanted them to know about it.
Oh, they definitely care about the audience. If you're spending $7-8 million on it, everything is measurable. There's a return on investment, and CEOs and boards are not going to sign off that level of investment unless they see it back in their business. So you do see beauty brands like Dove. They show up every year, and they must have a return on investment. It must end up in sales. It must end up in their brand growing. So I think it's a family thing as much as a male skewed sport these days. The Super Bowl is everyone, men, women, young, old. So that's why advertisers of all sorts, of course you have the beer brands that show up every year. You have the Bud Lights and the Core Lights. But now you also have the tech companies, and you have the beauty brands. You have political ads in an election year.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about obviously you were told Donald Trump will be in attendance. I don't know if that's finally confirmed, but that's the rumour. He would be expected to be. What would you expect from political ads? Are political ads in at the moment, or after the election? Is everyone, that's the last thing anyone wants to hear about over there?
It goes quiet. Last year, a good part of the ad break would have been the Republicans and the Democrats. They both showed up. And that dilutes the tone of it because, as I said, it's an entertainment event. And when the political ads come on board, it takes a more serious tone. This year, we'll be moving back from that. This year, it's back to more humour, more entertainment. The politicians don't really have a need to be there. They've just got elected. So I don't believe we'll be seeing many political ads this year.
Well, maybe the Democrats do need to be there for the future. Maybe. But yeah, I understand. I'm looking through some of the brands. We've got Hellman's Mayonnaise. We've got Doritos. Kind of feeling a bit hungry reading these out. FanDuel, GoDaddy, Squarespace, which I think Barry Keoghan, our own, is in. Budweiser, which you've mentioned, Lay's. We call them crisps, but they call them chips, right?
Yeah.
We've also got Angel Soft. We've got Him and Hers. We've got Coors. Yeah, there's a lot of beer here, all right?
Yeah.
Instacart, Ray-Ban, The Glasses, Uber, Taco Bell, Michelob. Okay, yeah. Beer and food is a trend.
Well, this is it. What do people do when they're watching the Super Bowl? They drink beer and they eat. So you do see all the beers there. You do see the delivery firms. Uber Eats have a huge ad coming out this year as well with Matthew McConaughey. You do see the car brands, because traditionally that's the heart of America, all these American car brands. And then lately, the tech brands, so you mentioned Ray-Ban and Meta, they're launching a smart glasses. They've actually launched it recently, but they have a big spot. They've got big celebrity backing with that. So you're seeing all the biggest brands in the world. The only rule really is, have you got deep enough pockets to be there?
Now, obviously, we've got our own Barry Keoghan. Do you know much about his Squarespace ad?
I do. The Banshee of Inisherin was obviously a big movie of his recently, and it is a take on that. So it's Barry going through on a bike, and rather than what he did in the film, he's throwing laptops through the various houses and in the fields, And it's just to say that anybody can have a website through Squarespace. So it's a humorous take on one of
Yeah, and there's a donkey involved, which is great.
He's riding on a donkey. Exactly.
It's kind of wry Irish, stage Irish, but it's quite amusing, the clip that I heard about it, which is great. And in terms of creative work, that's the agency you come from. The quality of creative work, and I know you're saying this is all about return on investment and nobody's doing anything for free here, but in terms of the creative work itself, you know, do creatives really get into this? Do they kind of go, look, I don't care how much, to some degree, the return on investment, I want to see my work up there. So just give our listeners an idea of how much of a, I suppose, it's almost like the place to be if you're a creative advertiser.
It certainly is in the US. We don't really have an equivalent in this side of the water. We obviously have the All-Ireland Finals, but there's no big advertising event like that. But there is a Christmas in Ireland or in the UK. It's all about creating a big campaign for Christmas and winning Christmas. And in the US, it's all about the Super Bowl. So creative agencies and brands need to outdo each other. Obviously, you need to get the return on investment, but there is also a side of it as to who won the Super Bowl from an advertising point of view and who gets to hold that crown for a year. So if you're a creative agency and you're a brand working on that, you want your ad to be talked about. You want your ad to be shared, not only for the return on investment, but just to show the other brands that, you know, you've created the best work, that you can do that. So it is a competition to see who can win it as much as who
can. And there's a safety valve, isn't there? Because you get them online beforehand, right? So if you've created this ad and you're going, maybe this is a bit edgy, you know, we're pushing the boundaries here a little bit, you can go online a day or two in advance. You can see the reaction. And if you had to make a quick snip or cut into the draft, you could do that, right?
You could in theory.
Whereas years ago, it was just first times watch was when it just came onto the TV screen. So there is a little bit of a safety blanket underneath these advertising.
There definitely
agencies.
Is. And advertising has changed as well. For example, last year, Michael Cera and Cera V had a campaign, and the whole campaign started 6 months before the ad went live. And they started a rumor that he was actually the brains behind Cera V, the face cream. And this internet rumor grew and grew. And then by the time the Super Bowl came out, they launched an ad just to double down on that rumor. And that was their campaign. So
wow.
It started months beforehand on Reddit and forums like that. And it ended on a Super Bowl break.
Now, we were playing at the start of our program, Clint Eastwood doing a car ad. Can you just walk us through from your own memory? And I know you're a young man sitting here in front of me, but from your own memory of the Super Bowl ads, best and worst.
Yeah. I remember the Clint Eastwood one because that was obviously at halftime, and that was during the recession, and the whole spot was about it's halftime America, let's reset. And that one stood out for sure, and it was of the time of recession for sure. But modern Super Bowl ads really started in 1984 with the launch of the Apple Mac. And what they did back then, they used Ridley Scott to direct an ad. It was based off George Orwell's 1984, and they created this dystopian take that took the form of an advert. And that reinvented what Super Bowls could be, because it got Ridley Scott to direct it, and it was big budget, and everybody stood up and paid attention. Wow, this is what we can do. So that was the first great one, we'd say. You probably remember the late 90s, the Budweiser, the What's Up.
What's Up, all that thing. Yes.
Yeah.
So which got very irritating after the third or fourth watch.
For sure. That was actually written by a Galway man. So there's an Irish connection to that. So
that's so surreal.
I mean, it entered culture, and for sure it ended up in an annoying space, but that stood out, and that was certainly a big one. And the ones like that have entered the culture. They've happened over the years, and for sure there's been big budget, and there's been different ways of bringing them to life. There's been more interactive versions of them. But the ones people recall are definitely the early ones, like the Apple ones, the Clint Eastwood ones, the Budweiser ones. There was another famous Budweiser one that had frogs in it. It was quite simple. The frogs were making ribbit noises that sounded like Budweiser.
Right, I remember that one too,
but
yeah.
But it's remembered. Yeah. So it's generally the ones that enter into the culture and enter into the lexicon.
But some literally are a complete waste of money.
Absolutely. And the ones that are the waste of money, they're not necessarily the ones that stand out as being bad. They're the ones that are forgotten. So
they're just bland.
They're bland. They're
fine.
They fade into the sea of sameness, of blandness, and they're forgotten about. And if you're a company and you've invested $7-8 million on that, and people can't even remember it the next morning, well, that is a monumental waste of money.
But what is also, it's a great fill-up for the advertising industry. What I mean by that is we're told endlessly that people are resistant to brand advertising, that Gen Z in particular just are not persuadable in any way. You come at that particular demographic in a different way. But yet here we are, $8 million for a 30-second slot. So it's almost kind of a redeeming the advertising creative industry by saying, no, these ads still can do a job. They can still boost the bottom line. They can still have an effect. Whereas there is a lot of Cassandra voices saying, oh, old school brand advertising is kind of dead. It doesn't seem to be if you take this as an exhibit.
And I think the reason for that is it's part of the wider entertainment show that's the Super Bowl. So people expect it to be as entertaining as the halftime show or as what's happening on the field. Whereas people go into a normal ad break and they normally try and ignore it, or they switch over, they look at their phone. But people go all in then for the Super Bowl to make something that's super entertaining. So I think there's a lesson there for any brand. If you seep into the sea of sameness, and if you don't attempt to...
You make it sound very ominous, the sea of sameness. I don't want to go there from the way you're saying that.
You don't want to visit the sea of sameness. But if you do that and you end up that your ad isn't noticed, well then of course people are going to avoid you. Or if you talk too much about yourself and you don't try and entertain and you don't get cut through humour, well then of course people don't want to hear it. But the Super Bowl ads, they go against that tide. And for that reason, people still engage with it and still watch it.
I'm going to do at some point a radio sign off, you know, from the sea of sameness. This is Evan Oliver. Carl, you've got to get yourself some work on that. You sound very enthusiastic about it. So you've got to get your own material in future years. But thank you for the moment for running us through. Good luck. Enjoy the game. If you're staying up till like 4 or 5 in the morning, some people, you can get out a bit earlier because you can see the ads without going all the way through, or most of them. So thank you very much for that overview. Carl Water is from the advertising agency, the creative advertising agency, Folk VML. And that's it for this week's edition of Taking Stock. This has been Emmett Oliver. I'll just remind you, the show is, of course, available as a podcast first on Friday morning on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy. And on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.